It's the Popmatic Podcast for July 16th. Oh man, I think I'm having a flashback.
Groovy.
We're gonna go all Smothers Brothers on you on this episode. It's the Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I'm Brian, and joining me today are...
Bill.
Moonbeam.
Bill. I mean, Crystal. Blue Persuasion.
If you're going to go with Moonbeam, I'm going to call you Moonbeam the whole show. So now we're going to stick with it.
All right, groovy dude. Far out.
And why we're talking this way, and why the person to my left is now known as Moonbeam, is because... This summer is the anniversary of Woodstock, so we thought we would revisit the summer of love, the good, the bad, the ugly of the 1960s, the hippies, civil rights, drugs, hair, you name it, or thereabouts, because arguably 1967 was the summer of love. Woodstock was in 1968, specifically August 15th, 1968. But we have something else we want to talk about when that date rolls around. So we figure, hey, summer of love is better than the summer of something else, right?
I want to talk about a song and the movie on which it's based. And that song and movie is called Alice's Restaurant. The song is written and performed by Arlo Guthrie, and to put it bluntly, it's not a song. Someone once described Alice's Restaurant as a musical monologue, which lasts 18 minutes and 34 seconds. Arlo Guthrie pointed out on an interview on All Things Considered that any American citizen who is convicted of a crime, no matter how minor, in this case it was littering, could avoid being conscripted to fight in the Vietnam War. The song describes the incident in great comic delight. The movie, on which it's based, was co-written and directed by Arthur Penn, who we talked about last week with Night Moves, the detective film with Gene Hackman. Mm. And he was fresh from his huge success with Bonnie and Clyde, so he could do anything he wanted, and he chose to do Alice's Restaurant. Alice's Restaurant, it also stars Arlo Guthrie, and it's one of the most unusual movies ever made. And what I mean is it defines any type of genre. You could say, is it a comedy? It is, but not really. Is it a drama? It is, but not really. Is it a tragedy? Well, it's that too, but not really. It takes all these elements and makes it work. It captures the hippie movement with a cynical eye, and the movie has a true melancholy tone to it. There is this extraordinary funeral sequence in which the song to aging children is sang during a snowfall, and it's one of my favorite moments in the movie. So check out both song and movie Alice's Restaurant, because it captures a time and a place. Crystal?
Well, before I get to what I wanted to recommend to y'all today, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention our sadness in the passing of Stephen Gaskin, the American counterculture figure and founder of The Farm here in Summertown, Tennessee. He died on July 1st after a lengthy illness, and he was a self-described hippie priest and freelance rabble-rouser. He was quoted one time as saying, while presidential candidate Bill Clinton had once famously claimed that he never inhaled marijuana, Gaskin boasted, I didn't exhale. So maybe we should dedicate this podcast to him. But meanwhile, back to my regularly scheduled program. One of my favorite hippies is better known as a groupie. That would be Pamela DeBars, a.k.a. Miss Pamela, whose 1987 memoir, I'm with the Band, is a lighthearted tell-all about her friendships and love affairs with rock stars of the 60s and 70s. Jim Morrison, Captain Beefheart, Gram Parsons, Keith Moon, Robert Plant, Jimmy Page, Mick Jagger, the list goes on.
Get tested.
One of my favorite passages from the book recounts the first time Miss Pamela hung out with Jim Morrison. And I quote here, "When I came to my extremely sensual senses, I was in the middle of a perfect backbend on Jim Morrison's tatty oriental rug, my purple velvet mini dress completely over my head, his girlfriend glaring down at me. I expected Rod Serling to appear in the doorway to narrate this ultimate in uh-oh moments. Miss P was a part of Girls Together Outrageously, aka the GTOs, a groupie group financed and produced by Frank Zappa. They recorded one album together, which I have not heard. It's probably out there somewhere. She talks in depth about her experiences with the GTOs, who were at one time featured in an article on groupie culture and as the centerfold in that same issue of Rolling Stone. Miss P goes on to recount her time dating actor Don Johnson, hanging out at parties with Hollywood types like Ted Danson. She went on to marry the musician and actor Michael DeBars. They have since divorced. But it's her love of music and her adventures with the so-called rock gods that made I'm With the Band completely fascinating and a perfect summer read. NPL has the 2005 updated edition with a foreword by Dave Navarro of Jane's Addiction fame. In 2010, Miss P was interviewed again by Rolling Stone, and she was asked if AIDS had killed groupie culture. And she says no. It was the same exact time John Lennon got killed. Everyone got tons of security after that. A whole attitude in the rock world changed to someone who's asked for our autograph would come back later and kill us. So if you've got a hankering to listen to some of the musicians Miss P hung out with, go over to Hoopla and check out Captain Beefheart, The Doors, Led Zeppelin, The Stones, and The Who. All right, Moonbeam, what you got?
Moonbeam, get it right, man. All right. I'm going to talk about a documentary about a cult in the early 70s that owned a fast food restaurant and had a rock band called The Source Family. It's pretty awesome. Like, I saw it at that theater that we mentioned all the time last year. Basically, starts out with, and I forgot to write down his real name, but, like, the leader guy is named Father Yod, who, during World War II, like, earned a Silver Star.
We don't need his real name if your name is Moonbeam.
Hey, man. You're harsh in my buzz. Eventually, he joined Sumco, but he left that, and he started his own. Basically, the bits that amused me the most is the restaurant and the band. The restaurant was called The Source Restaurant. Sold organic food. It was very, very popular. It made thousands of dollars a day during its height of popularity in the 70s. Many of the cultists there started as employees. There's some interviews of people who, like, you know, were teenage runaways or something, and they got there as, like, a dishwasher, and then they rose to the ranks of the cult. The band was called Yahowah 13. Of course, Father Yod had his hand in that, too. All the music was completely improvised. The soundtrack to the film is from the band, and I didn't really notice. it just sounded like, you know, your typical 70s garage stuff. But the records that were made are really expensive collector's items. Some of them only like two or three were ever like made. Also because I don't think anybody who's sane would have actually bought them yeah, back in the day. I thought it was really neat. I mean, mild spoilers that the cult never actually like, you know, you hear like documentaries about cults and you just assume that they're going to like murder people or
drink Kool-Aid.
Yeah. You know, go to Kiana or something. But no, there is no mass suicide or murder. You get from the interviews that the cult doesn't exist anymore, like as a group, but most of the members still kind of follow the organic free love teachings of the cult. Although I will say that Father Yod, he did eventually promote bigamy. Bigamy as in he had 14 wives. His original wife is extensively interviewed, and she appeared, at least in the documentary, to be the only member of the cult who got bitter and left. Which you can understand why. Yeah, it's like he's like, hey, I need 13 more wives, and she's like, wait, no, wait, what? What, no? Oh, yeah, and everybody in the cult has goofy names, at least for me. Although I'm Moonbeam, so how much crazier can it get? All the men, like most of them end in like Aquarian. The book that the documentary is based on was written by Isis Aquarian and Electricity Aquarian. Ruby. Isis is the cult's archivist. She discovered that there's way more music than was actually released, and they released 65 records. Take it away, Brian, man.
You know, you're named Moonbeam, but we were talking about Frank Zappa, and Frank Zappa named one of his kids Moon Unit.
All ties together.
All ties together.
Yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about a movie, too, and I think with The Source Family, that's an excellent movie, by the way. That's an excellent choice. it really kind of showed the, you know, the good and the bad side of, you know, the 1960s. And so I wanted to talk about maybe what some people might consider, you know, the bad side. And even though the 60s are known for the things that I mentioned in the intro, like hippies and LSD, some people were a lot more serious during that time. And say, for instance, the radical political group, the Weather Underground. So they were a radical leftist organization that engaged in violent direct action against the federal government. Not many people have done that in the 20th century, but they did. In 2002, there was a documentary made about them called, you guessed it, The Weather Underground. I don't think this language was thrown around a lot at the time, but today they would definitely be called terrorists and be put on a terrorist list. They intentionally never harmed any people, but they blew up many buildings. They accidentally blew up a few of their own members one time making bombs. But a lot of the movie is about their ethical debates about whether it was okay to harm other people or whether they should only damage property. It's interesting. The movie features talking heads with a lot of the members of the group, and they never went to prison. They were never charged. And the movie is as much a story about that. How do you be a terrorist organization that bombs federal buildings for a number of years, and a lot of these actually took place in the early 70s. I'm fudging our theme a little bit, and not get charged. So it's a story about that too. So, you know, why did they think that was necessary? Like, what was the political environment at the time that they would think that that was good or actually help them achieve their goals? And then how do you not go to prison for that? Like, how do you get away with that? And I think it raises a lot of very interesting questions. And I think to a certain degree, this is a forgotten chapter in contemporary history. Like, if you ask people about who the weathermen are that the Weather Underground are occasionally known for, you know, I don't know if people know about that.
You probably just get confused with the weather website. Like if you yeah, if you do weatherunderground.com or something.
Yeah, it's, no, it's a really famous weather app. So, no, not that.
Oh.
These people made bombs. So it's a really great movie. And the executive producer was, I think, an underrated film director, Mary Harron, who directed American Psycho that we've talked about a time or two on this podcast. But she was just the executive producer of this movie. If that's the dark side, maybe the more light side is the documentary Commune. And it's so much like The Source Family. It's so funny. But it's about one of the most successful long-running communes in the United States. So there's this commune was founded at Black Bear Ranch in California in 1968, and it's been going since. And this is a documentary about, you know, the commune in its heyday, what it was like, the things that happened bad, the things that happened that were good, and the problems of just like, okay, we don't like the way society is. We're going to form our own thing. What happens when you do that, and what things do you have to figure out? Things you have to figure out about communal living, the work, the food, the sex, like, can this actually be done? And that's what that movie is about. And I think I couldn't remember if I was thinking about the movie The Commune or I was thinking about The Source Family. Like, ooh. I couldn't remember because there were so many parallels between, because the members of The Source Family, they basically live together communally.
Oh, yeah.
You know, at the same time. So I couldn't remember if it was The Commune or The Source Family. And it's funny, I have a feeling a lot of the same issues also came up on the farm in the early days, too. So, something to think about. And I still dream of living in a yurt.
Tickling my fancy this week is the Tennessee State wildflower, the passion flower. If you don't know what a passion flower looks like, I encourage you to go out to one of the local parks, like Shelby Bottoms, and see one for yourself. The bloom is so unusually creepy, it's quite stunning. If you know about monarch butterflies, you know that they only lay their eggs on milkweed. Well, the passionflower vine is the only food source and shelter for the eggs of the Gulf fritillary, a quietly beautiful orange-brownish butterfly who begins as an orange caterpillar with these funky black spikes. So I say all that to say, get outside, kids, enjoy some nature time while you listen to this podcast, of course. All right, Bill, what's tickling your fancy?
Tickling my fancy is a CD audio called Michael Jordan, The Life by Roland Lazenby. And guess what it's about? Let me just state, I'm not a basketball fan. I don't even know who won the past NBA championships. However, when Michael Jordan played with the Chicago Bulls, you couldn't escape Michael Jordan. He was everywhere. He was selling underwear, McDonald's hamburgers, of course, the famous Air Jordan shoes, and of course, his six, count them, championships with the Bulls. Lazenby's biography goes behind the curtain to give us a look at the legend. So given I'm not a fan of basketball, and I'm recommending this engrossing biography should tell you something about Michael Jordan, the life, the CD audio. It would make a great trip book just to listen to. So if you are a fan of basketball, I know you'll love it. But even if you're not, you will find this quite engrossing and fascinating.
So Jordan has this reputation for being like notoriously inscrutable and secretive about his life.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, I wonder, I've seen this book, and I wonder, is this like a gloss, or is this really go in depth about, you know,
It goes in depth. It goes into his gambling. And considering, you see, it's not that he was just an ordinary basketball player. I mean, this guy, when he was playing with the Bulls, you're talking about Babe Ruth. That's how he was just huge. I mean, it gives you the big picture, but it does go into his competitive nature, which was kind of damaging. I mean, he was a true competitor, which led not necessarily to a gambling problem. His father once famously said, Michael doesn't have a gambling problem. He has a competition problem. And that pretty much was a major problem with him. So, I mean, he handled it very well, considering what a media star he was. I mean, he was huge, superstar status, but yet there is a dark side to him. Like I said, I wasn't into basketball, but at that time you couldn't escape Michael Jordan. I mean, there was a conversation, and I'm living down here in the South, people would bring it up. I mean, it was a major deal, and it goes into that. It kind of captures him and the era, too. So I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Mike.
Moonbeam.
Moonbeam.
That's right. Well, man, that's like my, you know, parents named me that, man.
So
gotta get my chosen.
I'm going to pull an executive producer and tell you that what's tickling your fancy this week is True Detective, because I think that we really need to talk about it.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, then.
Because it seems to be on everybody's mind. So what's happening with this True Detective show?
Well, okay. Let's see how much I can cram in about 10 minutes. Well, that was really, at first I was like, you know, oh boy, cop shows. I'm so tired of cop shows. Cop show. But so I kind of ignored like the initial like glimmerings about it. But then I kept hearing stuff that it has like Lovecraftian elements and, you know, bits about like philosophy, about like existentialism and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. I was like, ooh, tell me more. And then I watched it. It was great. Stars Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. The gimmick is that every season is a self-contained story that takes place over a period of years. Kind of a cold case files kind of thing. It begins in Louisiana in 1995 and ends in 2012. A woman is found by the side of the road, and she's tied up with a crown of antlers and this weird like tattoo on her back and stuff. Both the characters are really interesting. McConaughey plays I think it's Rustin, but they call him Rust. Rust Cole, who's kind of intellectual. He's all like thinky, but his primary, you know, character trait, at least for me, is he's very bitter. Very bitter. Not much, you know, all his jokes have like a very bitter quality, you know. He had an incident in his past that caused it, presumably. He's very atheist, too. He's got this interesting worldview about like how, like, you know, humanity and people are in general. I do like that, you know, in the past, he's a completely different person. He's very, like, you know, in suits and combed hair and kempt. And he's an ex-alcoholic. He's very, like, you know, teetotaler. While the present Cole is this burnout who's all, like, you know, has stringy hair and doesn't care about anything. He's like, whatever, dude. Much like me, man. Far out. In an interview on YouTube, I saw that McConaughey said that he felt that this was a natural, the end point of Cole's philosophy on life, that, you know, when you don't really care about anything, that that's how you kind of turn out. I don't know about that.
I think you might end up tending bar, but okay.
Yeah. Woody Harrelson plays like a, you know, basically kind of like a normal guy, but he's like more ruled by emotion. I like that, you know, there's kind of an interplay between the two of them. And both the past and present versions of him appear to be basically the same. One of the things I thought was really neat about the show is that if you loyal listeners may recall that I mentioned about a year ago a book called The King in Yellow by Robert W. Chambers, and the themes from the book crop up in the show, like the serial killer is called the Yellow King. And in the play, there's a – in the story, there's a play that whoever reads it goes insane. They see the truth in reality, and it drives them mad. And in the show, there's something that's similar to that, and that characters experience it, and they scream uncontrollably every time I laughed. It was great. I did like the kind of Lovecraftian elements of a backwoods cult in Louisiana. Very cool, suspenseful. Had a good time, but some people with the podcast may disagree with me.
Yeah.
So the reason I asked Mike to talk about that was because we actually had some differing opinions about the show. So Bill, what?
Well, you're mentioning the when I first watched the episode, I said, well, there's a show on NBC that's Hannibal. And it's already going into this territory, kind of this
the elaborate, placed victims.
And done it way ahead of this. And I just kind of thought, I've watched it because it was only 8 episodes. And I thought, well, I can stick through with 8 episodes. And I kind of thought, because I just thought it was like a lot of these shows that people talk about, it's just hype. And I did enjoy aspects of it. Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, they made me watch it through, and I've always Michelle Monaghan.
Yeah,
I've always liked her, and they're very good in their parts, as with the rest of the cast. But I just sort of thought at the end of it, I thought, well, okay, it just didn't leave that impression, and I just thought, well, I've been there, done that.
Yeah,
I'll just join in real quick and say I recently finished watching Broadchurch. I'm not going to go into it any more detail because I'm writing a review for our blog, but that was brilliant. Detective work. And so detective is in the title of the show. So I'm thinking, wow, this is going to be a great crime drama. And I like Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. But I got to say, I was disappointed in the lack, really, of the detecting element. And women were just poorly treated in this series, I think. I was just kind of gritting my teeth as I watched it. I thought it sort of redeemed itself in the last couple episodes, but overall, I was not particularly pleased.
So I mostly thought it was totally, totally brilliant. And I love it because the reasons that I think Crystal and Bill don't like it are actually probably the reasons that I like it, exactly the reasons why I like it. And the murder setup of there's an occult murder with an elaborate scene is totally boring. That is done 1,000 horror movies and 1,000 detective shows. Completely boring. And also the two characters are also completely boring. It's the same cop, good guy, bad guy that you have. But what it's good about it, for me anyway, was it was not about the detection at all. It was just about their characters and their interplay. And it's called, I think it's called True Detective because it's like a self-reflective show about those two characters. And it was all about the philosophy and about I love the time loop kind of aspects to it.
Yeah, that was really clever about the whole everybody goes in circles.
Exactly. And I totally agree that some of the female characters are undeveloped and there's gratuitous nudity. HBO seems to have a thing about that. But one of the reasons why I was kind of okay with that is that it's all about the fact that Woody Harrelson's character is the total hypocrite that does not know himself at all. And it exposes that the whole way through. And it's the two guys, they think they're large and in charge and they all know what's going on, right? And actually, they're both manipulated by the Maggie character, right? So she can be just as sinister as them. And it was about those two guys. Now, there were a lot of, I think, peripheral female characters that I think were treated badly in typical HBO TNA kind of ways. But but in a lot of ways, I think it was to expose the character flaws, especially in the Woody Harrelson character. Where it falls apart for me is the final episode, which is totally boring. You go and do the scary place and you fight the bad guy. I don't want to give away any spoilers, but there's some conversations at the end that represent, I think, a character arc on both the characters. And I think where the Matthew McConaughey character ends up is not true to what he was the whole way through the rest of the series.
I found that kind of disappointing.
Yeah. But his performance, before those last 10 minutes, was so completely intense. And even what it reminded me of, was No Country for Old Men, where it's okay, we've seen this sort of crime set up 1,000 times before, but the fact the performances are so incredibly intense, It's just like burns. I think McConaughey in particular, man, he's just on fire. Like, I could not take my eyes off him. Hey, I have this hunch too. The later Cole, when he gets all burly, I think he's channeling Frank Zappa. Because ooh, if you think about this, yeah. Frank Zappa has the same haircut, the same mustache, and talks the same way. Like, I'm cynical, I'm smarter than you, and I don't give a, right?
Yeah.
It's totally, if you watch like Frank Zappa interviews and then go back to like Cole, once, especially once he has the long hair, it's so funny how much they're the same.
Here, 4 years ago, we would be talking about Matt Damon doing impressions of him on the Letterman show. I mean, it's amazing how he's turned his career around.
I think he sold a soul to Satan or something. Because, yeah, you know, for years he was the, you know, shirtless romantic comedy guy. And, mm-hmm. You know, who cares? You know, he had potential, but he wasted it. So yes. Why should we bother?
But, I mean, you talk about total resurrection.
The other thing, man, I really liked about it, too, was the look of the show is really awesome. I think HBO has more budget. And one of the things that you kind of get, I haven't watched Hannibal, but like on your typical kind of cop show, they kind of look really cheap. And I was like, who's shooting this? And I was like, it's the same guy that shot Top of the Lake. And it was just like, that show is like so amazing looking. So
yeah, my mom went to school in Louisiana, and she says it looks exactly like that. Factory in the background with a lot of nothing.
So that's me. True Detective had some flaws, but I was totally transfixed. I think the things that Bill and Crystal said are really, really true, and they are real. But I think there's, like all good art, I think there's many ways to interpret it. Corrections. Last episode, Greg mentioned a superhero card game. He called it Avengers of the Multiverse, but the title is actually Sentinels of the Multiverse. And I believe this is an excusable brain fart because Greg said it's called Avengers of the Multiverse because of copyright issues with Marvel, which actually didn't make any sense, but it's actually not called Avengers of the Multiverse. It's called Sentinels of the Multiverse. So Greg might have to be added to the pantheon of me and Bill of people that say things wrong on the podcast. Also, I said that HeroClix was a role-playing game, and Greg said, oh, I played this role-playing game, Sentinels of the Multiverse. And I mean, if we're being purist, HeroClix nor Sentinels of the Multiverse really are role-playing games. But if you put either one of those together with Greg's project that he's doing with the kids, the superhero creation workshop, put it together, you would have a role-playing game problem. For more information, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
That's our website. And our theme music is by
Adam Dean, not Jimmy Dean.
Big Bad John.
Wasn't Jimmy Dean in like a James Bond movie?
Diamonds Are Forever.
Yeah. I heard that the other day and I was like, what?
Goody was a singer.
Wow. Oh, yeah. I remember. Yeah. Once I pointed out which party was, I was like, oh, yeah. You can tell. You know, the Howard Hughes guy is a terrible actor.